Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility presents Vermont Conversations with David Goodman, exploring ideas with innovators, change makers, business leaders, politicians, and activists. This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is underwritten in part by Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. By The Alchemist, serving the greater Waterbury community since 2003. By Fairpoint Communications, small businesses make it big with Fairpoint. By Let's Grow Kids, focusing on the first years of child development. By Green Mountain Power. And by National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years, working for a better tomorrow, as well as over 750 VBSR members. Here is David Goodman.
Welcome to this week's Vermont Conversation. Our topic this week is livable jobs. And let's begin with a quote from President Obama, who said in his State of the Union address last month, quote, "Nothing helps families make ends meet like higher wages. And to everyone in this Congress who still refuses to raise the minimum wage, I say this. If you truly believe you could work full-time and support a family on less than $15,000 a year, go try it. If not, vote to give millions of the hardest-working people in America a raise." So what are people making on the low end of the wage scale? Well, the federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. A person working full-time with two children at the current federal minimum wage earns $14,500 annually, which is below the federal poverty line. In Vermont, the minimum wage is $9.15 an hour, and it's scheduled to rise to $10.50 over the next 3 years. So a full-time minimum wage earner in Vermont makes about $18,000 a year, which is still below the federal poverty line. So what is a living wage in Vermont? That's the subject of a recent report from the legislature's Joint Fiscal Office. Here to talk about it are four guests. Jen Kimmick is the co-owner of The Alchemist in Waterbury. Liz Holtz is the founder and CEO of Liz Lovely in Waitsfield. Russ Bennett is the owner of Northland Design and Construction in Waitsfield and chairman of the VBSR Policy Committee. And Ellen Kaler is the executive director of the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund. So let's begin with Ellen Kaler. Ellen, this is an issue, sustainable jobs, living wages, that you've been working on for a long time. Can you just tell us what was the gist of the Joint Fiscal Office report that came out last week?
Sure. This report comes out every 2 years by the Joint Fiscal Office. It was something that first started coming out back in the year 2000. Again, it comes out every other year in the middle of January. And the intent of this report is to provide, in essence, a point of reference or a guidance document to private sector, public sector, nonprofit sector, businesses in the state to really understand what does it actually cost to live in Vermont so that employers can better gauge what they need to pay in terms of wages and benefits if it means that they're going to be considered a livable wage employer. So we're looking here for employers to meet the basic needs of their employees, because our feeling here is, and what we're really talking about, is that if you're working full-time, you're playing by the rules, you're doing everything society asks of you, then we think it's only fair that you should be able to pay your bills. And these budgets here, as they are built, are the bare-bones budget. They are not full of extras at all. They are very conservative numbers, actually. And the Joint Fiscal Office puts together seven different family profiles as a point of reference. So it's a single person, for instance, if you're living in Chittenden County, you need to make $17.26 an hour. If you are two adults living together but you don't have any children, then that's what's considered sort of the official livable wage. That's about $13 an hour each, or $27,000 per person. But if you're two parents and you have two children, ages 4 and 6, and you're both working, you each need to make about $20.31 an hour, or about $42,000 a year each, or $84,000 a year. So these, again, are very bare-bones budgets, They are based off of state and federal data sets that really look at what does it really cost for things like food, for housing, for transportation, for health care, for child care, for a little bit for clothing and household expenses, a little bit for telecommunications. And these budgets are wonderful because they indicate what does someone need to earn if they are on the Vermont Health Connect system, that they're purchasing their own health insurance, or if they have employer-sponsored health insurance. It also shows that these are folks that are paying taxes. So these hourly wage numbers or annual incomes include what somebody working at that, earning that earnings would actually be paying for real in taxes.
So, Ellen, just to summarize what you just said, the livable wage for a single person would be $13 an hour, but the hourly wage, a living wage, if for a couple with two kids, would be closer to $20 per hour for each wage earner.
Correct.
Okay. How has the livable wage changed over time? I know you've been working on this really since the beginning of the concept in the late 90s here. So give us a sense of what $13 an hour for that individual person, how that's changed.
Well, the methodology that has been used over time has continued to be tweaked a little bit based on what the data sets are really, how the data sets are collected. And for instance, this time around, the methodology was changed to reflect the fact that Vermont Health Connect now exists. So these are real-time estimates of what it really costs to live in Vermont. Memory serves me, back in 1999 or so, for a single person, it was about $8.50 an hour, and now it's up to $13 an hour. But I think that we've seen pretty dramatic increases in food costs, in energy costs, in housing costs. So if you take a look at any one of these individual line items in the way that these budgets are presented, I think most people feel that they are a pretty accurate reflection of what it costs. And over time, we've heard from a lot of employers and from individuals who look at these budgets and say, well, you know, my kids aren't ages 4 and 6, but I've got two teenage boys. Or they'll say things like, well, I don't have this level of transportation cost because I live in town and I can walk to work. So every single family, obviously, is completely unique. But what these budgets do is it gets you within about 5% plus or minus of what is likely to be the case for these different family configurations.
Okay, let's turn to Russ Bennett, the owner of Northland Design and Construction in Waitsfield and the chairperson of the VBSR Policy Committee. Russ, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Good to be here.
So, Russ, tell us a little bit about your own business and what you've decided to do in both now and in the past in terms of the wages you pay.
Well, we have a design-build construction company. We design and build this is our 37th year in business, so we're starting to figure it out. And we build custom homes, high-end quality stuff for design, for whether it be Magic Hat or Ben & Jerry's or many of the companies that we know around here. And we also work on the visual design and planning components for the largest music festivals in the country, and that's, you know, over 50,000 attendees. So that's a little bit about what we do. We like to think that everything we do is quality, and I think that means that you have to treat people and you have to create quality jobs. So we've never wanted to do anything at the expense of our employees, and I've always wanted to be able to create good jobs for people. So I think we don't just make widgets or houses or improve businesses. We also provide, we also create good jobs.
So as chair of the VBSR Policy Committee, what's the position that VBSR has taken on living wage?
Well, I think you alluded to it a little bit in the beginning, David. A living wage is a term. I think we prefer to talk about livable jobs. And a livable job is not simply the dollar amount. It would include the benefits that you might get with your job. So, for example, Our employees have full medical, and they have days off, and they have sick days, and they have vacation days, and, you know, they have all of the things that you would hope that a good middle-class job would provide, a decent life for a person that works here that can then spend time with his or her family.
And this is, what are some of the other things on the, you know, the VBSR policy committee in terms of aspects of jobs and leave and things like that? This is one of several aspects of what you would call a livable job. What are some of the other aspects?
The wage, you mean the other aspects of a livable job?
Yeah, with sick leave and such.
Yeah, every business is going to look at it differently. We have flexible days that people can use for whatever. We're not interested in knowing how sick somebody is or having them have to justify it. But, yes, a livable job, I think that's really what we're talking about. And I think the juxtaposition of livable jobs to the minimum wage, which at this point is a misnomer. It's, the minimum wage isn't a livable wage. It's not even a survivable wage, quite frankly, in this area. So VBSR, as a member of VBSR, if you're paying the minimum wage, that means these people are eligible for, as you pointed out, they're below the federal poverty level, many benefits and subsidies, as they probably should be. So that means that all of us who either like or don't like to pay taxes are paying taxes to support the businesses that are paying below a livable wage. So it would behoove all of us to improve those people's lives by paying them a livable wage. And they would become taxpayers as opposed to tax burdens.
Okay. Well, Russ Bennett, thanks for joining us now. We're going to turn to our guests who are in studio with us. Jen Kimmick is the co-owner of The Alchemist in Waterbury. Jen, you were recently at the State House and were testifying about livable jobs. What has moved you as the owner of a business, the owner of The Alchemist, to get involved on this issue?
Like Russ, as employers, John and I have always worked to create livable jobs. And it's not just paying more than the minimum wage, because that helps, but it's just a piece of the puzzle. It's paying wages that are livable, helping people take time off when they're sick, when their children are sick, when their parents are sick, helping them pay for health care, just overall quality of life. Knowing that our employees can really count on a paycheck week in and week out, no matter if they're sick or their children are sick. That's the most important thing. So while raising the minimum wage is critical, it's only really a piece of the puzzle. You know, I talk to other business owners about this a lot, and they're skeptical, and they say, oh, well, you know, you make Hetty Topper. You can afford to pay people more than the minimum wage. You can afford health care. But the fact of the matter is John and I started providing livable jobs back in 2003 when we opened our pub, and we had a very thin bottom line. But we understood that our investment in our employees was the best business decision we could ever make, and it certainly paid off for us.
So I'm curious, you know, when you did start a business, and food businesses and restaurants are famous for taking, you know, years to be profitable, how did you justify to yourself living, you know, kind of probably on razor-thin margins at the start to pay more instead of paying less?
We realized early on that if we professionalized jobs that aren't typically professionalized in the food and beverage industry, that we could retain staff, that we wouldn't be wasting dollars on advertising, classifieds looking for new staff, hiring, training, and overtime for people covering shifts. So early on, for all of our kitchen staff, dishwashers, cooks, prep cooks, we gave them salaries based on the number of hours they worked a week. And we based that salary on just a little bit above what the livable wage was at the time. And then in addition to that, we would provide them with health care and days off if they were sick. What we found was our hiring and training cost us nothing each year because no one left. Our retainment was incredible, but beyond that, our employees were happy. They were able to take time off when they were sick. It's just worked out for us. in so many ways.
Well, we have a caller on the line. Andrew is calling from Washington. Andrew, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Good afternoon, folks. Thanks for taking my call. I'm just calling to give you some actual numbers from a 36-year-old single male with no dependents who makes, I make about $24,000 a year. And particularly when it comes to now having to spend about $250 a month on health care, the subsidies for single males that was just mentioned a short time ago are not really the case. I've applied for just about every subsidy that I think I could, and all of them have been denied because I make $23,000, and most of the cutoff points are sitting around $14,000 to $18,000 a year income. So I don't know who comes up with these equations for livable wages, but I do think that they need to be relooked at for individuals like myself. With expenses of just having to pay college loans and now health care and all the transportation and things that you're talking about, I just think that the livable wage that you folks have, that seems to be a bit low to me.
I think that's compelling because we're here to defend the livable wage, and we're hearing that the livable wage isn't enough, and I couldn't agree more. One thing that jumps out at me when I look at the livable wage report is that you yourself, as a single male, can live off $330 of food a month, and we know that's a difficult feat. So I think that even that backs up the argument even more. Thanks.
Well, I do appreciate the show. It's been very informative. And
Okay, well, let's turn to Liz Holt, who is the founder and CEO of Liz Lovely in Waitsfield. Liz, welcome to
Hi.
The Vermont Conversation. Tell us a little bit about Liz Lovely, what you make, and what your employee practices are.
Liz Lovely Cookies started in 2003. We make gluten-free cookies that we distribute nationally all over the country. We employ 18 to 20 people, depending on the season. And part of the mission of starting Liz Lovely was always to create livable wage jobs. We actually based growth on trying to create more jobs. That was just one of the missions when we started, as well as creating a high-quality product. And I, just as Jen was saying, I totally agree that the quality of the job you're giving to the employee just shows you the quality of the product you're going to put out. There's less turnover. People don't have cars breaking down. They don't work three jobs. Like, our job is, in the bakery specifically, is very physically demanding. It's a very high skill job. It takes about 6 months to train in. The turnover of that for us, it takes about a year and a half to pay off that training. So we need people to stay a long time. And part of what we offer is not only a livable wage, but it's an open pay scale, so you can see how you can get a raise, when you're going to get that raise, how and what skills are needed to move up. There's a lot of opportunity within the company to move from the production floor to other parts of the company, but we also have a four-day compressed work week, so you always have Friday, Saturday, Sunday off guaranteed. We also do what Jen was saying, is we offer salary, not meaning that you work more than 40 hours, but that you're guaranteed your 40 hours. So if sales are low and we only need you for 25 hours, you're going to get paid for 40. If we have to shut down production because equipment breaks, you're still getting paid. We have paid
time.
How
can you afford to do that?
It's tricky. I mean, food businesses have thin margins to begin with. Gluten-free products in particular, the ingredients are much more costly. Our margins are thin, but I believe that trying to call myself a sustainable business and not having the lives of my employees be sustainable would be so hypocritical. So to me, I sleep better. Our brand is better. The corporate culture inside the company, I'm calling it corporate, I mean, there's 20 people, but the culture that we're creating, it's everybody's a family, everybody's a part of that product, and everyone is equal.
There was an amazing story that I remember about Liz Lovely that we heard about probably about a year ago on Vermont Conversation, which was when your place got flooded during Hurricane Irene. Tell us what happened then.
Well, it wasn't our factory. It was a store we were opening, because where we are, we're not really zoned to have tours and a showroom or a retail store. So we, Dan and I at the time, opened or tried to open a retail store in downtown Waitsfield. And the day before opening, it got completely destroyed. We had spent probably 3 months of our own sweat equity on that. And everything in the store, I mean, it was the ceilings, the walls, nothing was left. So we took that as a sign, no retail store. That was not a good time. Sure. But we felt so grateful we could show up at work the next day and make cookies. So many people lost so much more than us that we were just grateful to have our other business still standing.
So this is an interesting connection between you and our other guest here, Jen Kimmick. Jen, what happened to the Alchemist during Hurricane Irene?
Well, about 8 months before the Tropical Storm Irene, we began planning a second brewery, a production brewery. We started build out in January. We were delayed. We were broke all summer. The restaurant was doing pretty well, so it was financing the rest of our build out. Finally, we had our canning line installed. We were ready for the first cans to come off the line, and the night before our first can rolled off the line, the storm came, and it demolished our pub, which was pretty ironic because it had really helped us open up the brewery. I will say that in the immediate months following the flood, that our new brewery really enabled us to then fix up the building that had been flooded. So it was a complete switch. Like Liz, of course, it was devastating, but we didn't go through what people who lost their homes went through. You know, seeing people, elderly people, low-income people, sitting on their lawns with their photo albums and their clothing spread out around them. I mean, that was truly heartbreaking. I think for us, the hardest thing was the loss of jobs. So right away, we buckled down to make new jobs. We brought about 60% of our employees from our pub over to our production brewery, and we just focused on making jobs there as quick as possible. I just want to say we have probably 10 employees now that work at our production brewery that worked at our brew pub. Two young people. One young lady is, I think she's 27 now. She started working for us when she was 17. She was a hostess, and now she's our office manager.
Wow.
She didn't go to college. She stayed with us. She has a great job. We have another young man that started dishwashing for us when he was 16. He's now 24, and he runs our distribution truck for us. So, you know, we're really proud to be able to, you know, professionalize these jobs and create opportunity for young people in Vermont that maybe aren't able to go to college or just don't see themselves going to college.
How did the experience of the destruction of part of your business during Tropical Storm Irene, how did that change you and your approach to business?
That's a tough question. I don't know. I think it made us just very aware of how fortunate we were for our successes and how fortunate we were for the great community we live in and our employees, because the support was just incredibly overwhelming. It really was. It was humbling. And, you know, I will say to this day, we really don't focus on the bottom line. We focus on creating good jobs for as many people as possible. And, you know, I hear that from so many other business owners, Liz, Russ, so many great business owners in Vermont that are really trying hard to do the same thing.
Liz, what would you say about, you know, out of disaster, what was the silver lining for you and your business?
I think it was showing us what we really need to focus on. I think, you know, we had gotten a little bored in our other business, not that it wasn't taking off and doing well, but we saw it as, you know, an opportunity to give back in the community and create a little space there. And I saw it as a way to refocus on just growing the other, you know, distribution part of our business more. Like Jen said, just create more jobs, like better jobs maybe than standing in a retail store for us. Just helped us, you know, rally everybody and say, okay, we're going to refocus on what we do have. We're lucky for what we already have built. So let's just build on that.
Okay, well, we're going to take a break for the news, and we'll be back in the second half hour talking with Jen Kimmick of The Alchemist, Liz Holtz of Liz Lovely about livable jobs. Stay tuned.
As Americans, we have someone to do just about everything we need, from fixing our cars and doing our taxes to someone to watch our children and even style our hair. We also have people who fight our wars, men and women, sons and daughters, who choose to serve so the rest of us won't have to, risking their lives for our freedom. Some who return will have suffered catastrophic injuries, coming home paralyzed, blind, or missing limbs, and for once, they will need someone who can do something for them. The Wounded Warrior Project offers comfort and support to our most severely injured troops from Iraq, Afghanistan, and other conflicts around the world. The Wounded Warrior Project helps these courageous men and women transition back into civilian life with hope, heart, and true healing. Please support our injured heroes, because sometimes the greatest casualty is being forgotten. To help, please go to woundedwarriorproject.org.
A message brought to you by the stations of Radio Vermont.
AP Update, I'm Ed Donahue. At the White House today, President Obama is trying to put a human face on attempts by Republicans to scrap his immigration policies. Here's the AP's Mark Smith.
A day earlier, it was Americans who'd had life-saving treatment thanks to his health plan. This time, it was young immigrants. He's allowed to stay in America because they were kids when their parents brought them here illegally.
These kids are American, just like us, and they belong here, and we want to do right by them.
My name is Maria Paley, and I am undocumented and unafraid.
Obama is telling so-called dreamers, like Connecticut college student Maria Paley, who came from Peru at age 5, he's confident he can beat back GOP efforts to have them deported. Mark Smith at the White House.
Senate Republicans are trying to put Democrats on record again as opposing legislation that would give that would fund the Homeland Security Department and overturn the president's executive actions on immigration. AP Update, I'm Ed Donahue.
Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, pleased to provide Vermont Conversations with David Goodman. Underwriting is provided by National Life Insurance. Fairpoint Communications by Let's Grow Kids, The Alchemy Brewery, Fletcher Allen Healthcare, and Green Mountain Power, as well as over 750 VBSR members.
Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation, where we're talking this week about the idea of livable jobs. Our guests this week are Jen Kimmick, the co-owner of The Alchemist in Waterbury, and Liz Holtz, the founder and CEO of Liz Lovely in Waitsfield. We were talking earlier in the show about the legislative report that just came out on livable wages. It was talking about the livable wage in Vermont for a single person being $13. But Jen Kimmick, you've pointed out that there's a scale here that changes pretty dramatically in terms of what a livable wage for a single person is versus, for example, a single parent with kids. Talk about that.
Absolutely. The $13.11 an hour, like you said, is for a single person with shared housing. If we look at a family with a single parent and one child, the livable wage goes up to $24.57. A single parent with two children, $30.97. And these also assume employer-sponsored health care.
And when we say livable wage, there's not a lot of fat in that wage.
So there isn't. There's not vacation time. There's not a retirement fund. You know, they're not all these things that, you know, we kind of think of when we think of the American dream, you know, being able to retire someday or take a vacation. None of that. This is just barely getting by.
So this is the realistic number that they've come up with, the legislature has come up with, about what it actually costs to pay your bills.
Correct, yes.
There's a gender gap in terms of wages. Tell us a little bit about what you've learned about that.
Absolutely. In Vermont, one-third of single women are living in poverty, even though they work full-time. So those are full-time workers. The most staggering number for me is that 35% of women... I'm sorry. 35% of women compared to 19% of men did not earn a livable wage last year in Vermont. And I think that's very significant. It's almost twice as many women that aren't earning the livable wage. And then also when we look at single families, single parents, many of those are women, as we know.
So this difference in an hourly pay scale between $13 an hour for somebody, you know, let's just say a young guy in a, you know, with a roommate, mm-hmm. versus what you would have to pay a single mother of two in your business in the, you know, 30-something dollar an hour range. So for you as a business owner, Jen, that's really significant. I mean, it's going to be a lot cheaper for you to hire that single guy than that single mom. How do you justify that in your bottom line?
Well, we never take into account if someone is a single parent or if they're married when we hire them. With that said, we do look at each individual differently, and we try to do our best to give them the best livable job possible. You know, I think even looking at the $24.57, we're above that. But it's a challenge. You know, when we talk about raising the minimum wage, and we know that there are small businesses in Vermont that really do struggle. I mean, we're working hard to get up to $10 an hour. Will we ever be able to get to $24 or $30 an hour? I mean, it's a stretch. I mean, it's going to take a long time. So that's why we really have to look at all of the other issues that go along with the livable wage. And that's the earned sick time, universal health care, quality child care and education for children, things that will really help lift people out of poverty. And then I just want to say, giving a livable wage is not a handout. By earning a livable wage, workers are no longer dependent on government poverty programs. So, you know, it all comes back in the end. I think we just have to look at the big picture, really.
Hmm. Liz Holtz at your business, Liz Lovely in Waitsfield. What difference have you seen that it's made that you're paying your workers a livable wage?
I think just beyond retention. Retention is probably the biggest. I think also just... not having a disparity between the production floor and the office. I think it's in a business like ours, there's, you know, there are people getting dirty and there are people not. And I think trying to bridge that gap where we're all the same and we're all equally contributing to the success of the business, that's created more of a family atmosphere and leveled the playing field for everybody. That's really important in a business like ours. Otherwise, there's like an us against them kind of mentality and like a class hierarchy thing that we really just try to avoid.
We're talking about livable wages and livable jobs here on the Vermont Conversation this week. You can join the conversation by calling 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. Liz Holtz, how do you deal with this issue of the gender gap and the disparity in need that we were just talking about with Jen Kimmick about, you know, the needs of a single young guy and a single mom with two kids are, you know, vary greatly?
Yeah, that's a tricky subject. I think, you know, like Jen said, it's not like we're looking at the person and paying them a different wage based on their situation, because that would be weirdly discriminatory. But it's something to consider when we set the floor of what our pay scale is. And like Jen said, trying to place that person in the right place in the company and make sure they're getting opportunity to move up if they need to move up. But it is tricky because you can't look at each person and say, oh, well, you deserve to earn more. Like, I'm a single mom. I have two kids. I would not be able to live off of $13 an hour. It's not possible. So how do we give those people opportunity to keep moving up and keep getting more opportunity? Like, you don't stay at the bottom of the training wage at Liz Lovely for 10 years. I think it's a tricky thing.
What is the floor at Liz Lovely?
I think that before this came out, it was $12.50. And that's why we use this livable wage like this report to show us what the floor needs to be to keep moving it up. And that's just training. You stay there for a very short period of time and then you move up. Like I said, I think one of the most important things in food businesses in general and food production is that you guarantee them the hours, because it's easy to say, I pay people $18 an hour, but they make $25, you know, they make 25 hours a week and then they have to get another job and then they're hustling and they're trying to schedule their lives around that. That's an impossible way to live. Like our hours are 7:30 to 5:30 Monday through Thursday. You have a real job and it's guaranteed. I think that's an equally important component to the wage. Otherwise, you're not bringing home that amount of income. You're saying, yeah, I make that an hour, but I only make, work 25 hours a week, and then I have to bartend, and then I don't see my kids, and I have to get a babysitter, and it's a mess. I think that's a big piece nobody talks about in the food industry.
Jan Kimmick, talk a little bit about some of the myths that you've encountered, people who are just skeptical of this idea.
Mm-hmm. One common myth I hear from other business owners is workers earn what they're worth. The market determines the value of their labor. And all I can say to that is the minimum wage is not determined by market forces. The lowest income bracket has been getting steadily poorer, and the real value of the minimum wage has steadily declined since 1968. Another one, people need to start from the bottom and work their way up. That's the American way. And again, I said before, a living wage is not a handout. By earning a living wage, workers are no longer dependent on government poverty programs. And to assume that anyone can make it if they work hard enough ignores structural oppressions forced by low-wage workers. And, you know, I think we're all well aware who those people are, people that just have limited skills, different biases.
In doing a little research before this show, looking at the different minimum wages, and just to remind listeners what we said at the top, the federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour, which translates to a full-time worker earning $14,000 annually, which is below the federal poverty line. In Vermont, the current minimum wage is $9.15 an hour, which translates to about $18,000 a year, which is also still below the federal poverty line. Vermont's minimum wage scheduled to rise to $10.50 an hour over the next 3 years. And the living wage we're speaking of, which is what the legislature has just said in a report is the bare minimum to cover your bills and survive, is $13 an hour, and that is for a single person in a shared housing. So I was shocked, actually, looking at the federal minimum wage at $7.25. There's so many numbers been flying around. The president has been talking about $10.10, and so we sort of forget what the real number is. What do you observe? I'll ask Liz Holtz. You know people in your community making the minimum wage. What is it? What happens for people who are making.
I mean, it's a struggle. I don't think we all realize like that's somebody's reality. It's easy for us to think that's a number on a page, but those are people's lives. Especially if you add kids to that mix. I don't know how you can afford to even get a job and pay for childcare and expect to make a living. Like, how are you? It's not survivable. To me, it's not survivable, especially in where I'm living in the Valley. That is not a survivable circumstance.
So let's expand this. The idea Russ Bennett mentioned at the very beginning was we're not just talking about a living wage. It's about a livable job.
Right.
What does that mean to you?
I mean, to me in particular, like I said, it's about guaranteeing that you have, like Jen's saying, the professionalism, like creating, making these jobs professional, meaning you are guaranteed this work. This is not a, you're here if it's here and you're not if the work's not here. I also think maternity leave, we've paid maternity and paternity leave. It's treating these people like they are a part of the growth of the company and a part of the company. I mean, I wouldn't exist without the people who work for me. I mean, it's easy for me to be like, oh, I'm Liz Lovely and I created the recipes. I'm nothing without these people. I need them to show up. All these people have been with me a long time. If they get pregnant and want to come back, I want them to come back. I want to make it an attractive place where this is this is a long-term commitment I'm making to you and you are making to me. I think it creates more respect, and it's just a better work environment for everybody.
Talk a little bit about what it means to be a woman-run business. How does Liz Lovely reflect the values of you as a woman owner?
That's an interesting question. It's probably more emotional than other businesses would be run. There are a lot of women who work for me. We don't have many men. There are two men in the office. I think the bakery is mostly men at this point. It goes up and down. You know, I think it's, I would like to say it's a compassionate place to work. I wouldn't know what it's like to run the business as a man, but I do think it's has more of a feminine touch to it. Things are discussed. People can come to me with their problems. I think we have real people's lives there. It's not just a business relationship. It's what's going on with everybody. Is everybody okay? If someone's not doing okay, how can we make that better? I think it has heart. I think that business has heart.
Jen, you're the co-owner with your husband, John, of The Alchemist. What are the challenges of running a business as a couple? There must be joys and pitfalls of that.
Honestly, John and I have always worked really well together. We met working together. The pub was great. The brewery is great, but we definitely have division of labor. We always have. John's been in charge of the brewing side of things, brewery operations, and I've always been in charge at the restaurant. It was the restaurant itself, human resources, financial planning, and that's carried over to the new brewery. So John oversees brewing operations. I oversee pretty much everything else upstairs. And, you know, we confer with each other. We work on little projects together. We talk about marketing, but we respect each other's space, and you know, we just it's a great environment to work in. Much like Liz, we have a lot of women that work for us. We have women in the brewery. And in our office upstairs, we have 6 women. We actually don't have any men that work upstairs.
Upstairs being?
The offices, the distribution, you know, our online store, all the management. So, you know, like Liz said, we are always very aware of what's going on with people's personal lives because we all care. You know, if someone looks a little down one day, we'll find out what they're down about, what we can do to help. And that carries over to all the men that work for us, too. We all just really care about each other. We treat each other as human beings. It's pretty special.
Do you ever encounter in the, you know, the work world, skepticism, you know, about a woman running a business like this, or?
I wouldn't run into that because I don't get out that much. We go to the office, we go to the brewery, we do our work, and we go home. We stay pretty focused on what we're doing. So I would tend to tune anything like that out.
For you, this idea of a livable job encompasses a lot more than the wage. What are you trying to expand that concept to mean at The Alchemist?
Providing a job and creating a workplace where people can stay for a long time, a job that's sustainable, a job that gives people the freedom to be with their children when they're sick, take care of their parents when they're sick, be able to have health care, be able to go on vacation 1 or 2 weeks a year. These are things that are really important, and these are things that are going to help lift people out of poverty. You know, it's cyclical, and unless we do something now, the problem's just going to get worse. So, you know, just looking at the whole package, what can we do to really help improve people's lives? And for those people that started working for us who were living in poverty, what can we do to help lift them out of poverty? And I think we've been successful in a few cases.
So what do you think counts for what has happened to The Alchemist, where it now has this cult following? And I have to recount an encounter that happened just before we went on the air, where Roger Hill, the famous WDEV weather man, was walking out and said hi to you, and he said, "How come I can't get Eddie Topper anywhere?" So how did this go viral?
Well, boy, we never set out to make a beer that would be distributed regionally or nationally. We really only wanted to sell Hetty Topper in Vermont. So when we first opened our production brewery 4 years ago, we were making 300 cases of beer a week. We thought that would be plenty. Today, we're making 1,900 cases of a week, and we're distributing it about 20 miles in each direction, and our stores sell out pretty much in a day. It just has, Hetty Topper has this momentum that just keeps building and building. And obviously, it's not Vermonters that are consuming it all. People are driving in and buying Hetty Topper, and that's great. It brings money into the state. But, you know, people ask, is it the marketing? Is it because you're controlling the market by not making enough? And I really don't think it's any of that. You know, we put so much effort into acquiring the best ingredients, the best hops, the best malt. We don't filter our beer. We distribute it ourselves and make sure it's absolutely fresh. If you're buying it in at one of our stores, it's been brewed 3 weeks before. So, you know, it hasn't been sitting in a warehouse. But we do all of these things to create the best IPA we possibly can in a package. And I think people taste the difference. You know, to say it's the marketing, which we don't have a marketing team. It's John and I, or the lack of production. I just don't think that's true. I think it's a quality product, just like Liz's cookies. They're great. They're homemade. People appreciate craft and quality.
Why not go big?
Well, we've grown 600% in less than 4 years, so we're growing as fast as we can. There are certain things that are keeping us from growing faster. You know, we're maxed out production-wise in the space we're in, so we can't make any more where we are. We are contracted for our hops several years in advance. Those are limited. So for us to really go much bigger than we are at this point, we would have to take a drastic step, go public, bring in a CEO, you know, the whole company would change. For us, the most important thing as we grow in an organic way that we can handle is staying privately owned, because we really believe that by staying a private business in a small community, that we can give back more than if we went big and went public.
You have really just in Vermont, probably a lot of people who've perhaps offered you some advice on this very thing. I think of Ben and Jerry and the challenges they faced. Is there some advice you've been given that's been particularly helpful to you in how you run your business?
Sure. I mean, people give us great feedback all the time. We love what you're doing. Don't go big. Don't sell out. And, you know, that's what we listen to, because we love Ben and Jerry's. But, you know, Ben and Jerry, they're not making ice cream anymore. And we love to make beer. We don't want to step away. That's just not who we are.
Liz Holtz at Liz Lovely, what do you think is the perfect size? What's the perfect balance between work, life, and everything that you want out of your business?
I think the perfect size is what Jen is saying, is to keep it manageable, to keep it contributing back to the state that we're in. I'm still looking to grow slightly bigger. We still have capacity where we are. We're not running, you know, full tilt 7 days a week, you know, night shifts. I hope to get there. I still think there's a lot of room in the marketplace for our product. I think we're kind of like a hidden gem, and the mainstream is really just starting to understand gluten-free. This year I hired a VP of sales, and we're trying to hit that market, because the bakeries are really where people need an allergen product like this for their children. And, you know, in-store bakeries aren't really providing that. And we're a fresh product. We're not like a grocery store sit on the shelf. I mean, we do have a crunchy line now that has a 9-month shelf life, but we're a fresh product, a fresh experience. It's a quality homemade, your mom, grandma made it experience. And I think that that's still a really big hole in the market. So I'm hoping to get bigger, hoping to be in Jen's kind of position. But I still think I love what we do. I really stand behind what we do. And I hope to keep doing it.
Do you ever get feedback or even pushback about taking political stands as a business person?
Of course. You know, I think there's controversy in what we do. You know, we're in Vermont, so I feel like we have more liberties than we do and out in the world, because we're nationally distributed, you know, but that stuff doesn't bother me. I don't take that personally. I think that's part of the fabric of who I am and who we are as people, and the Vermont kind of thing. So, I mean, Ben and Jerry's took the same kind of hits. I feel like that's what we do.
So if you were speaking to a business school class, what advice would you want to impart to those folks who are considering, you know, Wall Street and versus, you know, perhaps doing what you're doing?
I would say, are you ready to work really hard? I think everyone works hard, but I think owning your own business, you've got to be able to take your lumps. Not to sound egotistical, but it has not been an easy road. I don't believe it will ever be an easy road to stay in business, to stay current, to stay relevant. Growth is very painful. And to be in the food business, you must keep growing. I feel like to sustain what you're building underneath you. You know, you hire more people, then you hire overhead. It just keeps going. Ingredients get more expensive. So you got to work hard. You got to continually be vigilant about what you're focused on and continue to work it. I don't think there's ever a time where you let off the gas. So if you're going to go to Wall Street, maybe you have an easier time. I'm not sure.
Jen Kimmick from The Alchemist, what would be your advice to people about to head out into the business world and looking at the various options?
Well, I will say if you are starting your own business, especially a small business like we started out, just focus on your local community first. Take care of the people around you, create a product or a service that your local community wants, and then work from there. That's worked for us anyway. And then my other thing is, you know, especially the more successful you get, you need to have thick skin.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
And this is sort of the upside down interview. I normally ask this a lot earlier, but how did you come to be, kind of the queen of IPA brewing in the Northeast? What was your route to The Alchemist?
I met John in 1995 at the Vermont Pub and Brewery. I worked there through college. I went to UVM. And shortly after graduating college, I met John. He had been hired on as a new brewer. And we quickly discovered we both had a fondness for beer. John was an amazing brewer, so I was quite smitten by him. A year later, we were married, and for the first 6 years of our marriage, we started working on our business plan. We worked on the financial planning. I worked primarily on the financial planning operations, and John really focused on recipe development. And then we landed back in Vermont in 2001, and we opened our pub in 2003.
And continuing on this upside-down interview theme here, Liz Holtz, what brought you into being the master baker of gluten-free cookies?
Well, I was vegan, actually, for 12 years. I'm no longer vegan. But I just saw a hole in the market for the products I was buying. They were not the same experience of eating a normal product. Like, I'm obsessed with cookies. I grew up baking, like, every day with my grandma, my mom. So I started the business based on that, and then it turned into sort of an allergen marketplace, and their number one request was gluten-free, and I felt like those people weren't getting that experience in life either, and I just feel like that's where my skill lies, is to find that, okay, how do we make this like a normal experience, and I just pointed myself towards gluten-free. We turned over maybe 4 years ago to 100% gluten-free, so just by the wayside, just kind of happened.
Is there something you wish you knew or had been told at the beginning of starting a business?
What do I wish I knew? I think if you just lower your expectations of what it is going to be, I think expectations really get you in trouble. Like how fast you're going to grow, what it's going to look like, what the road bumps, you know, are going to be. You really can't take anything for granted. So I think lowering your expectations, really sticking to a plan that you make, those are really important things.
How about you, Jen Kimmick? We're going to give you the last word on this. What do you wish you knew when you started this, as you and John were sketching out what it would look like to start a business?
I would agree with Liz. Expect the unexpected. Always have backup plans. And and really think about what some of your worst case scenarios might look like and how you're going to deal with them so that when they come, you are okay and you know how to deal with them.
Okay. Well, Jen Kimmick, co-owner of The Alchemist in Waterbury, and Liz Holtz, the founder and CEO of Liz Lovely in Waitsfield, I want to thank you both for joining us on the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. We'll be back next week at 1 here on WDEV.
You've been listening to Vermont Conversations with David Goodman. Listen Wednesdays at 1 as Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility and their some 750 members, along with additional support from National Life Insurance for over 150 years, working for a better tomorrow, Fairpoint. Small businesses make it big with Fairpoint. By The Alchemist, serving Greater Waterbury since 2003. By Let's Grow Kids, focusing on the first years of child development. By Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. And Green Mountain Power, all partnering with customers to promote clean, reliable, and cost-effective power. Join us next Wednesday at 1 o'clock for Vermont Conversations with David Goodman.
I'm locally owned and operated, 96.1 WDEV, FM in Warren, FM 96.5, Barrie, AM 550, WDEV, Waterbury, Montpelier.
President Obama put faces to the attempts by Republicans to derail...